welcome.
I'm extremely happy to be here. Thank you for the invitation to speak and to do service to this program. The number of minutes again? 30, 25, 30?
30, 40.
All right, great.
Hey,
Josh.
Yeah,
also alcoholic.
Hi, Josh.
I'm really honored to be here today. It's a huge thrill for me because my forefathers come from Norway, which started my interest in coming here, and they came to the U.S. and to Canada 3 generations ago, and I was very close to my grandmother who passed away 6 years ago, and just before she died, I was going through with her family history and growing up in this small town in Saskatchewan, where it was all Norwegian immigrants, and she mentioned a brother of hers, which I had never known growing up, and I'd never heard spoken of in the family, and was basically an unknown to me in my life. And then she revealed that that Uncle Donald was an alcoholic, and who had been, you know, from a young age, boisterous and spirited young man on the prairies, and had discovered alcohol, and he was, you know, she didn't go into details about his story, but she ended up by saying that they put him on a one-way bus to Vancouver, where he died on Skid Row, and there was no Alcoholics Anonymous available to him. And I was, you know, I'd been in the program a while at that time, but I was shocked that my dear, loving grandmother would put her brother on a one-way bus to an unknown a destination and a horrible fate. But that is exactly what the family at that time had to do, and I have no doubt that I'm a drink away from that same fate, because without this program, there's just no alternative. Found out along the way that he had been treated in asylums, where he was put in bathtubs and received electric shock therapy and the kinds of alternatives that exist for people like myself, and that are still being widely employed. So I'm extremely grateful to have another alternative, you know, and to have a home wherever I go, and people who I can connect with and enjoy the fellowship and find a softer, easier way to stay sober. I was raised as a child of the hippies, and you know, my grandfather died very young in my mother's life, and I was raised by her and my in Canada, and yeah, enjoyed a very interesting alternative lifestyle. In terms of drugs and alcohol were widely available, and people were experimenting with all kinds of stuff. And at 6 years old, we moved down to Boston, where I met my father for the first time, and lived out in the woods, spent some time in New Hampshire living, you know, with the teepee set up and growing pot in the backyard, and people doing all manner of activities. And yeah, I was, you know, this little scamp running around in the woods with my dog, and wasn't expected home. You know, had a pretty free rein of it. Would And it was great. You know, I enjoyed the freedom of my childhood. And but then one day they came along with a bus, the school bus, and they said, "Okay, you get on, go on to this bus here." And they let me off at this school, and it was a small town in New England, and all the kids had shaved heads, really short cuts, and they had little crocodiles on their shirts, and they all had their stuff together, and I had cowboy boots on and a vest and hair down to here, and I said, "I think I got off on the wrong spot. I don't think this this place, nah, I'm not sure about that." And it was not a very successful experience in school. You know, I always experienced driving around, if we saw the police, you just kind of duck. And, you know, and when I saw the teacher, I just kind of saw the same thing. I said, "Okay, I get it. That's the teacher there. That's like the cop." All right. So, yeah, I didn't have a lot of skills for or training for dealing with, you know, what I considered this very weird society. And I was not very happy. And, you know, but when I was in sixth grade, I moved back up to Canada, moved to this town called Calgary. It's a little, it's actually bigger than Oslo. I mean, it's a mid-sized city. And I got to reinvent myself as a kid. And a part of that was I got to get a hold of some pot, got to hang out with a group of kids who I could tell right away were doing the kinds of things I wanted to do. You know, they just had that certain attitude, that certain look, saw things the right way. And yeah, it was great. You know, I felt actually it helped a lot. It helped me to fit in. Felt like I had was able to have some popularity or some social skills. Got into, you know, minor scrapes, breaking into things and busting car windows and just trying to steal little things, just being a goofball and partying on weekends and having that relief. I mean, when I picked up the first drink, it was down to my toes. It was on. I just was like, you know, solution, check. That was all I needed. It was, I had some pretty bad scrapes my first time out. Ended up totally bombed and getting home and falling down the stairs and all this stuff. But it was pretty much on. And my friends got into, you know, pot was right at the beginning, but really got into LSD. And, yeah, they, you know, we really just sort of the same vein of, you know, this whole government thing, this whole school thing, you know, pretty much anything I could attack, be negative about, you know, I just didn't really have any grounding in terms of, I kind of had a sense that I was kind. I really did. I really felt that I was kind, and there was something authentic about people that I would look for. But all of the other stuff, you know, the good and the bad and the rules and all that stuff, I was extremely oppositional, ridiculously oppositional. And, yeah, I mean, again, though, the alcohol was a great, great thing for me. And I got some of my best friends in high school, and we're still close, and none of them are alcoholic. And, you know, without it, I don't know exactly what would have happened. I was pretty tightly wound. So, you know, I'm not sure. And I don't want to close the door on that chapter of my life. And it was a wonderful tool. And, you know, I think from the beginning I was an alcoholic, but I wasn't experiencing the consequences. Then I went to college, and then I pretty much, I turned a corner because I got involved in the commercial side of drugs. And that, what that did for me, was basically cut me off from any kind of mentorship or guidance. So you've got the youth don't take advice shirt here. And, you know, I wasn't at that point, I was, you know, 18. I wasn't taking advice. I had my own program. It was the Josh program. And, you know, that's pretty much what I was doing. I dropped out of school my first year. I was very heavily into drugs and alcohol. I followed a band called The Grateful Dead. I did pretty much anything and everything I wanted to, and you know, wasn't very successful in relationships. Wasn't in terms of friendships. It really was kind of tough for me to establish. And so basically, at that point, I think somewhere around there, it really, really became kind of like, you know, the switch would go off and I was out. And if the switch went off, it didn't matter where, when, you know, I wasn't going to be, I wasn't going to slow down. And, but I ended up moving back to Canada, where I got back together with a girlfriend who I'd known in high school, and we ended up together, and you know, God bless her. I don't know how or why. You know, it says something in the book that we have an earning capacity above average, which I'm not quite sure about that one either. But also this idea that we have attracted wonderful women in our lives, which in this case is absolutely true. But you know. I really didn't have any maturity. I didn't understand what it meant to be, make a commitment, or what it, you know, I didn't know who or what I was doing. I was lost, and I was grabbing onto life preservers, and we did get, I proposed, and we were married. And when I graduated from college, we moved immediately to Taiwan, which, you know, as a young single person with no prospects and a lot of debt, that's, I don't know. That's the first thing that occurred to me. And we immediately had a child, which, again, you know, her parents were, I think, shaking their heads on that one. And I was doing my own thing. So I it seemed just par for the course. For, you know, well, this makes perfect sense. Looking back at it, I realized none of this stuff is in any how-to books for young people. You know, it was amazing we got out of there alive. It was, you know, stayed there 3 years. I started a company, and I had my first experience with Alcoholics Anonymous there because I had some big jackpots. I mean, I was incapable of being a faithful husband, and I realized at one point that I was absolutely, you know, that I was screwed, that alcohol owned me, that if I picked up, I was gone. And I had an uncle who, on my father's side of the family, who has been in the program more than 20 years now, and he had taken me to meetings a long time, and he had sort of, you know, he'd identified me. I think he had helped me out, saved me a seat. You know, said, "Well, just come along, we'll show you. Just take a look. I don't know, nothing serious." But I reached out to him, and he actually met up with me in Thailand and brought me a big book and introduced me to this program. And so for a year, my first year sober was in Taiwan. No meetings. As the part of Taiwan, there was no meetings at all, at least no English-speaking meetings that I was able to find. And I had a big book, and I had a lot of fear. I had a big jackpots, and I pretty much had identified that I was screwed. But, you know, a year later, I had the most successful year of my life. I started up this company. It became quite successful. I was, you know, on top of my game. And, you know, guess what? Started thinking, I guess it's going to be a good idea. Well, why don't I grab some beers? And, you know, actually, no. You know what? The first thing that happened was someone brought me a ball of hash. And, you know, I said, oh, well, I never really had a huge problem with that. So, you know, next thing you know, I'm burning every single morning and, you know, doing my thing. Well, a week of that, or maybe 10 days of that, I said, well, this is stupid. I mean, you get that, it's kind of harsh on the throat, you know, I need to put that down with something. So that put me on a long run. I mean, that just, you know, and of course, immediately everything started going sideways in the business and everything else. And so I ended up back, we ended up back moving to Boston, where I thought, okay, well, I can give this AA thing a shot again. That worked really well. Oh, let me just see how I'm doing here. So that up until that point, I really hadn't dug into the program. I had some white-knuckle sobriety. Basically, I tried workaholism is what I was doing in Taiwan. I was just workaholic and investing a lot of time into this, and I still hadn't really patched up relationships. I hadn't learned how to be a father. You know, there was still some major issues. I was reading the Big Book regularly, though, which, you know, is incredible. Piece of literature. It's not a program by itself unless you work it, but that was my introduction. But when I got back to the States, and I knew a friend of mine who had been in the program, and he brought me over to the first meetings where I got where I tried to get sober, and it was a clubhouse. It wasn't a program. It was a clubhouse. It was folks. And yeah, the clubhouse was cool, and you know, there's some new people to meet, and I had just moved from Taiwan, so I didn't know what was going on. I went once a week. I asked for a sponsor at the group. I didn't get a sponsor, and I just kind of thought, well, this program isn't that good. I tried that. It probably went 3 or 4 months, but ultimately it was even less successful than when my ass was on fire, because at least then I had some burning sense. In fact, I think I had a higher power for that year. I mean, it was really the only way that kept me sober. And so went out again. At that point, I've got a 4 or 5 year old girl. I'm married. I managed to get a job as a teacher in Boston Public Schools, and I'm living about 45 minutes to an hour out of Boston. And it's a long commute in. It's a long day teaching in an inner city school, and a long commute out. And I went in, did my work on the way out, and then I tried to walk from the train station home without picking up a package of alcohol, and it was impossible. I really changed my style of drinking. I was a spree drinker. I would go out and go crazy and not come back for 3 days, you know. And at that point, I put enough controls and limits on myself that it just became a maintenance, you know, daily maintenance. But boy, you really can see it. You know, you can really, I could feel it in my bones that there was, you know, I get off the bus and I'm in the train, and I was just like, you know, I could tell there was no way I was going to make it to my house without picking up. And I just became a daily maintenance drinker. I would drink to pass out. You know, I was completely absent as a father. I had a lot of anger issues at that time as well, and as I've always struggled with that. It was basically a slow death, but it kind of looked all right on the outside. It looked like, oh, he's pulling 9 to 5, he's working hard. People didn't see what was happening on the inside and see the yelling, see the fear, see the fact that I knew I was beat, and I was running through the motions. You know, at that phase and in other phases, I could always do one thing well. And so then if I went to talk to some of my uncle, you know, my father or my uncle or someone in my life, I would just tell them about the one thing. You know, I wouldn't mention all the chaos. And so I kind of think, you know, that was to the degree that I was a functional drunk, it was I could be doing this one thing. You know, the fact that, well, you know, it seems like your relationship with your daughter kind of sucks. Well, yeah, but I'm doing this. Oh, okay. You know, and then later on, oh, I'm being a great dad. See, I'm doing this stuff here with my daughter. Yeah, but, you know, you're not paying your bills. Like, oh, well, you know, I'm not really thinking about that now. I'm being Mr. Dad, you know. And I could always kind of do one thing and fool myself into thinking that somehow I was keeping the show on the road. But I was just fooling myself because, you know, it was just a sinking ship. And my body was falling apart. And I really didn't have a terrible, terrible I put so many controls on myself. I didn't get DUIs. You know, I wasn't doing drugs. I didn't get picked up for stuff. I would get to work really early and sometimes find myself puking getting off the T and looking around to see if any of my students were getting off the same train as I was. And I felt about that big, you know, less that they see Mr. Lawrence coming off and, saying what's going on with him, you know, but, the last day of that and along the way at that time I tried many times to stop. I had New Year's resolutions. I had some really nice charts with, you know, working out and number of drinks of water and all kinds of little things. You know, but without this program, for me, it was just nothing stuck. And the last day that I had a drink, it was a Saturday, just a typical night, really. I drunk myself, pass out. Next day I had a basketball game, which I play on Sundays, which starts at 2, and I was, you know, I probably got out of bed at 12, and I just reeked of alcohol. I was playing, you know, if you've had just vodka coming out of your pores, and you just have that very distinct aroma, and I'm on the court, and I kind of know everyone's just like, what the hell, what's going on with this guy? I took a break, went to the bathroom, and I looked at myself in the mirror, and I was 10 years older than I look now. I was just falling apart, and I realized that, you know, I was, this thing absolutely had me, it owned me, and I was going to just be on a sort of autopilot till I died, until I fell apart, you know, and that's basically that bottom. And I got in the next day into my first meeting, and that was a different meeting, a meeting where there's a lot of focus on the program. I immediately got a sponsor. A group of guys, about 12, 15 guys, that did a 12-step program where sort of my home group was essential for me to hear from other men in this program what it means to work the steps, you know, what that actually looks like when you're at work, when you're in your home, when you're dealing with your parents and your siblings and your wife and that really made the difference. And it was a couple guys who came in around the same time I did and who I could see, because I looked at, you know, this guy, Joe, who, you know, Joe looked like he just came off of a spy novel. He was all huddled up and had this cap on, and he's this Irish guy and, you know, looked, kind of looked like a mobster or something, you know. And 6 months later, he was smiling and he was, could just see a sparkle in his eye. And it was for him that I kept coming back, slowly but surely that was it. You know, I got a sponsor who spent endless amount of his time and energy, was available at all times, went through some professional things. Basically what happened was, my life just took off, absolutely took off. It was it's been a complete blasting into the fourth dimension for me. I really can't explain it except for a higher power in my life, but living life for me, when I pick up, when I'm drinking and trying to do this thing, it's like trying to win a marathon with, your legs tied together. It just doesn't work. You know, I can't do it. And once I picked up this program and started working with some guys and working with a sponsor, you know, it just it's been incredible. So I went from that teaching job. I just started a PhD program. You know, 4 years later, I was doing a postdoc at Harvard. My career was blasting off. In terms of my relationship with my daughter, that took an awful long time. I think anger was a huge and continues to be a huge issue for me. And, making amends apologizing when I'm, make mistakes has been like, that's just the go-to for me in terms of my relationship with my daughter. And, you know, today she just arrived here on Saturday. She's here with me. We have a phenomenal relationship. She attended my last time I took a chip last year. I don't have the skills to do fathering. And I learned those all here. That's the hugest gift of this program, because it's the most important relationship I have in my life. My relationship with my wife, we amicably divorced. Like, I guess it's been more than a year since we've been divorced, and a couple of years since this process has gone started. talk about miracles, you know, an amicably mediated separation with someone, you know, having a loving parental plan for your daughter, being able to work together to do things. I mean, I'm looking to fight every time. And, you know, I've somehow managed to have this transpire where we've been able to move on and still have a great outcome for my daughter. It's, you know, it's mind-boggling. It certainly was nothing that I accomplished. It was only by being in this program. Mm-hmm. And, you know, now I'm here as a part of my visit to Oslo because I've had an experience of meeting someone new in my life. And, you know, I don't know where that's going, and I don't need to know. But the thing about this program has been that if I had set a list of what I wanted when I came in, I would have undershot what the program has been, because I couldn't even imagine what the program has given to me, because I didn't even have it in my vision to know what kinds of, you know, satisfying life looked like. I mean, I just didn't have that vision to see that my relationships were not there, you know, and that where things could be in my life. And I just try to remember that. I think that's really a huge centering piece for me, is that, you know, I don't need to be the director, but it's just that it's not just because that's self-destructive, but also because the gifts of this program and where I'm supposed to be, not for me, but for service, for what I can do in the world, is way beyond what I can imagine, you know, and I just need to allow myself to show up and be present and to do the next right thing. And, you know, that's basically my job for the day, is to, you know, to do the next right thing for today and not get too wound up in where things might go, because at the end of the day, I am just one small cog, you know. I'm one of 7 billion of us on the planet, and that's pretty much all I need to handle is my side of the street today. I'd just like to say a little bit about service in this program. I've been extremely lucky to work to be a part of a home group in Irvine, California, the Solutions Group, which meets every morning at Mariners Church. And there's a group of guys there that, you know, together they help me stay sane, and we help each other stay sane. And we stay very close, very connected. And, you know, the program has allowed me to see other people come in here and struggle and be successful. And there's nothing that beats it. There's nothing that beats seeing someone bloom in the program and to be able to unconditionally love a group of guys, you know, and see them support each other and feel that support. How am I doing on time here? Yeah? Mm-hmm. Good? More? I think I'll take a wrap there. Thanks.